And we're back once again. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Mike, Mike, and Oscar as we reach the tail end of this month-long journey. We finally are in the home stretch, the final week.
Yeah, Michael has slashed our Achilles tendon at this point. We're hobbling. We're limping. Yeah, he's giving us a good slash to the back of the leg.
That's right. We're like the Black Knight from the Monty Python and the Holy Grail movie. It's like, it's just a flesh wound, but there's nothing left. We're just ravaged. This is Mike, Mike, and Oscar. I am Mike One. This is co-host also Mike.
Also Mike here. Yes, sir. We got the curse of Michael Myers. It is the curse on the series.
What's
in a way.
What's that old adage, save the best for last? Right. We're not doing that.
We did the opposite. Well, unless maybe, you know,
right.
Halloween 2018.
If you count 2018, then sure, we might be doing that. But as far as these movies, we're kind of attacking them in a standalone style. And today we're going to be doing Halloween 6, which is The Curse of Michael Myers. We're going to be commenting on the plot of the theatrical cut, but I will bring up the history, backstory, and what the producer's cut has and the differences and all that. We'll get into all that backstory as we go. And we'll also be covering Halloween Resurrection. I will warn you, I cannot stand that movie. So before we dive into cast and crew, also Mike's going to walk you through that like we always do for these reviews. It's important to note that it's pretty clear that Halloween 6 was being thought of. Halloween 5 has some tie-ins. We have Michael with the thorn symbol on his wrist, and also the most obvious link being that the ominous man in black character.
The ominous man in black. That's his surname.
No Will Smith here. And not to mention that if you go look at any of the cast interviews that happened, they all comment that Halloween 5 was actually thought of during Halloween 6, I should say, was being thought of during Halloween 5, and actually that director was shooting takes with the purpose and intent of them being used in Halloween 6 to his knowledge and not any of the cast. So why did it take 5 years for 6 to come out after 5? Why is it because of a studio change? Was it because of a disappointing box office? Probably some combination. The most disheartening fact is that Jamie Lloyd is back in this one, but it's not Danielle Harris. There was a huge controversy as far as getting Danielle Harris. Some people in the studio, the Akkads, wanted her back. She's actually a good family friend of the Akkads, but the studio, Miramax, and the Weinsteins were in charge, had their hands on throughout all of this, and they didn't want to pay her more than scale,
right.
Which was an interesting story because she actually had to pay to get emancipated from her family to be an adult at 17 because Miramax was adamant that the Jamie Lloyd character be played by someone who was 18 or older.
So you didn't look down or blink during that whole rant.
How's that?
I am thoroughly freaked out right now. Basically, I'm like Kara Strode, who bumps into Paul Rudd, who's Tommy, and Tommy's just like a conspiracy theorist.
Right.
You're Tommy.
Also,
is what
I've
I'm
just
saying.
Been staring in your window at night from across the road.
Also, the
telescope.
Table is tilted up towards me, down towards me, I should say, because you are aroused.
I assure you that has nothing to do with
there's
me.
There's one bead of sweat.
It doesn't get that. Yeah. So let's start. We're doing Jamie Lloyd. Why is this not included within the Halloween 4 and 5 movies that we did?
I'm just laughing because before the pod, Mike's like, so here's how it's going to go. You're going to do cast and crew, and then you're going to do this production, and then, you know, I'll just pepper in. 9 minute rant.
Exactly.
Later. No, I got to start with this. I get it. No, do what you have to do.
Thank you.
Therapeutic for
it
you.
Really is, because I have to defend this movie. I know how it's not the greatest. Why isn't the Jamie Lloyd storyline part of 4, 5, and 6? Well, because again, these movies are a little bonkers. They're not exactly coherent. They don't exactly tie in anywhere with the prequels as much as 6 tries to, I guess.
Yep.
So we wanted to have them as standalone. And now, after that rambling introduction, Michael, walk us through the cast and crew who was involved with this movie.
Yes, directed by Joe Chappelle. He's known as a producer.
Let me tell you about Joe Chappelle's social security number.
Go ahead. He's known as a producer on The Wire, Fringe, and Chicago Fire, Michael. So the taste profile that gave us the most prestigious show in the history of television.
Yeah.
Also gave us The Curse of Michael Myers.
Well, he had to get through this before he can think about bigger and better things.
This is where he cut his teeth, I suppose. He also directed Thieves Quartet and Phantoms. I'll let you make a Ben Affleck as the bomb in Phantoms joke.
I haven't seen Phantoms in years.
Well, it's a
I
Kevin
don't even
Smith.
Remember. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You see, just to thoroughly explain this joke I had,
go ahead.
I was going to pause for you and mention that I was going to pause for you to make a Yo, Ben was the bomb in Phantoms joke from, like, was that Clerks 2?
I see.
You know,
see,
Clerks
yeah.
2.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that would have been funny to like three out of our audience members.
And Kevin Smith, should he ever come around to her. Yeah, I got you.
All right, good. So this is Joe Chappelle still.
It's proper we're starting in this way for these movies, by the way.
Also directed episodes of those three TV shows. I have to mention them again because it's like 14 minutes ago. The Wire, Fringe, and Chicago Fire again. And he also directed a bunch of CSI Miamis. Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers was written, of course, by Charles Manson. And all the characters from 12 Monkeys.
Yes. No, actual monkeys, I think.
I made an assumption there. This screenplay was written by Daniel Farrens, who also wrote The Girl Next Door. That was a comedy in the late 2010s.
Yeah, no, not late 2010. I think early,
late 2000s, maybe. And this year's The Amityville Murders. Halloween 6 brings back Donald Pleasance as Sam Loomis, and they dedicated the film to his memory.
What a picture to go out on.
As he passed away in that year of 1995. Paul Rudd plays Tommy Doyle. This was a strange casting. He plays that little boy from Halloween 1 who falls on the pumpkin, who knows rules about the boogeyman. He is especially crazy and obsessed with Michael Myers living at the boarding house next door, run by a cult member boarding house woman. It's all kinds of crazy, yeah. But of course, Paul Rudd is in the Ant-Man and Ant-Man and the Wasp MCU movies there. He's in a lot of Judd Apatow films, Wet Hot American Summers, Catcher Was a Spy, Ideal Home, and Mute of this year. This year's movies, he's kind of doing a callback to kind of the shitty movies he used to do.
This is a very un-Paul Rudd performance is the word I'm looking for there. So
yeah, he's not a great babysitter of an infant child. He's just like,
you know. To be fair, he did find it just in the bus terminal.
It's true. He has an instinct to find infant children in bus terminals. All of that was creepy to say.
Sure was.
And it will be further creepy to talk about. Marianne Hagen plays Kara Strode. Mike, who the hell is Kara Strode?
She is.
I regret asking this question immediately.
I looked at this up on the Halloween Wikipedia. She is that whole family is the cousin, I guess, of the Laurie Strode character that Jamie Lee Curtis plays so infamously. So they really have tangential relationship at all, if anything.
So this was an aside in a later Paul Rudd line where he's like, oh, by the way, the Strodes who live across the street. And that was like 20 minutes after we already met that family, but we don't know who that family is. We just meet a family.
Never get a clear explanation, not even in the producer's.
We don't. Yeah. Yeah, we don't know if it's a daughter of this jerk of a guy, abusive man, or it turns out to be a daughter of the abusive man.
Yeah, the one closest to Michael is actually, I mean, it's Jamie Lloyd, who's in the beginning, and it's also Mrs. Blankenship, who's the old lady in the house Paul
Rudd lives in. Member, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So we don't know who these people are, but they're people in a movie. So Mitchell Ryan is Dr. Wynn, buddy of Sam Loomis, and spoiler alert, also the Man in Black.
Here comes the Man in Black.
Ryan is a longtime character actor from Gross Point Blank, Lethal Weapon, and Liar Liar. Kim Darby plays Deborah Strode. Bradford English plays John Strode. Keith Bogart plays Tim Strode. And Devin Gardner plays Danny Strode. Who cares? Apparently there's a whole new Strode family in this movie. J.C. Brandy plays Jamie Lloyd. We'll have to talk about that once more in a minute. Halloween 6 also stars Mariah O'Brien, Leo Gator, Susan Swift, Janice Nickrame, Alan Echeverria, and George P. Wilbur comes back as the Shape. George P. Wilbur slimmed down a little bit, though. That's something to notice.
Also an obese. He also was apparently very funny on set.
Nick Castle skinny, but he's closer to Dick Warlock.
Yes.
You know, his height and weight and speed profile there.
Defensive tackle we were dealing with in five there.
Right. He played Michael in Halloween 4. So some movie specs.
Yeah, I'll talk about specs. Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers, directed by Joe Chappelle, produced by Paul Freeman, written by Danielle Ferens, based on, of course, the characters from John Carpenter and Deborah Hill.
Should give them the Halloween 5 cops, those goofy cops sound effects every time we mention
it.
I like how you reaffirm the highlights of my cast and crew there.
Critics actually did say, gave them the score of the goofy cops from Halloween 5, essentially, because the Metascore is a 10. That's low. The IMDb is 4.9 out of 10 on 25,000 votes. Rotten Tomatoes is 6%. 6%. 2.7 out of 10 average. 2.7. 30 critics took the 32 critics took the time, and the aggregate score they took the time out of their day to give this was a 2.7.
That's terrible.
That's
and
I'm, not I
apologize,
good.
By the way. I'm an adult male. I'm just making fart noises for a
only
minute.
In age. 38% audience score. Average score of 3.5. 3 out of 5, I'm sorry, on 67,000. It's distributed by Dimension Films. So, of course, the Weinsteins got their hands on this. It was released right before October, September 29th, 1995, a runtime of 88 minutes, produced by Miramax Films, Nightfall Productions, and Trankus International. It was made for a reported $5 million budget, relatively decent box office run of $15.1 million, made 3 times its production budget.
Right.
Who knows what it made in the special Blu-ray collections and all that jazz that I definitely have not spent money on a couple times over. Absolutely not. Talk about some production nuggets, Michael.
So, like you said, Daniel Harris played Jamie Lloyd in Halloween 4, Halloween 5. She's 17 years old, gets herself emancipated at a court, going on the intel that she'll get the part of Jamie Lloyd once more for Halloween 6, The Curse
really
of Michael
got
the Myers.
Short end of the stick. I should have prefaced this. The backstory of this movie is actually kind of fascinating, and it's certainly more juicy than what's actually in the film itself, because the theatrical cut, which we're going to talk about, is just a bizarre mess.
So Halloween 5 already kind of slipped up in many ways. They killed off a main character from the movie before that. They showed that they're kind of vicious with Rachel's character.
Right.
And they're trying to do the same thing here. I don't know why they doubled down on that sentiment, because Mustafa Akkad is kind of in charge. He's kind of okaying things. We just saw Halloween 5 not work in terms of box office. So the powers that be that are in control of this thing are a bit rattled. Why wouldn't they go back to more of a Halloween 1 motif like 4
sure.
did? I don't understand that.
Could be something to do with they knew the vitriol that the new Jamie would be treated with, so they wanted to get her out of the picture.
Jamie could have done this movie for scale. Danielle Harris could have done this movie for scale, which was maybe a couple thousand, which she spent a couple thousand to get herself.
That's what she says in the
emancipated
documentary. She wouldn't have covered her legal costs of fighting to do the movie in the first place.
Because they're paying her scale, or whatever it was, $80 an hour or something like that. So, I mean, it's good money, but it's still not up to what she spent in the courtroom. She decided not to do it after she read the script and saw that her character gets killed brutally in the first act.
Can't blame her. Yeah. And she only got emancipated to reprise this role. She says specifically she did it because she thought she owed it to the fans. She was a good family friend of the Akkads, who still own the license of the Halloween franchise.
Right.
And the Akkads, at least she says, fought for her, but it was Miramax who basically turned her away because of what you just said. They basically told her, you'd be a bit character, you die in the first act, why would we pay you more than scale?
And if you follow Harvey Weinstein's career and that company's career, they completely do this every chance they get.
They're just
cheap, and they just make enemies with so many people.
Well, he made enemies on this one, certainly.
This is just miscommunication, you know? I mean, if she knew that her character was killed in the first third of the script, would she have gotten herself emancipated to make sure she got this role?
I just think
miscommunication.
So.
Nobody's got their shit together. It's lousy. So, essentially, there's a lot of reshoots in 94, 95, the winter thereof.
Oh, yes, there were.
Back in Salt Lake City where they shot this thing. Tonally and narratively, everything has changed based on the aftermath of this test screening where 14-year-olds, the audience was comprised by a group of 50 14-year-old boys that hated the movie.
Because the movie was made for them.
So to try and make this movie more palatable for them, they up the pace and way up the pace.
Yeah, which by the
and
way,
then up the pace some more, and then all got a drug habits of cocaine and speed and whatever else does things that make you really insane. And they gave those to the editors, and they upped the pace even more. And
this was in 1995, so the MPAA was well established by now. This is an R-rated movie. It came out as an R. So why are you even caring what 14-year-old boys think?
The stylized flash cuts became prominent in the final theatrical version of the film, and many people talked about it, how it was more MTV video than feature film. And the pacing was just complete catastrophe, as you'll see if you rewatch this movie.
Yeah, the editing certainly does it no favors as well, but this is the theatrical cut. So why is the theatrical cut so radically different than the producer's cut, which there are major differences in story alone? Dan Ferris, who Mike said was hired as the writer, was the man that had written the treatment for the Weinsteins after the Weinsteins went into this bidding war with basically against John Carpenter to secure the rights for this film. A lot of this information is coming from the documentary, which is on the Blu-ray disc, part of the 16-disc special Blu-ray special edition pack that came out a couple years ago commemorating the 35th anniversary of Halloween. Again, I'm a psychopath. So Dan Ferris was the one who actually brought up the Thorne storyline to tie everything together. Paul Freeman, the producer, was given reins. He chose Joe Chappelle to come in. So we have Ferris writing the script. Chappelle's supposed to helm. Malcolm Akkad, who's the producer on the film, claimed that the producer's cut, it was the cut that the producers, the Akkad family, preferred and that they wanted to go with.
So that makes some sense to me, because remember, the Akkads are in charge of Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, trying to steer this franchise more towards the occult, more towards a cult movie like The Wicker Man, like these other films that were being made in the late 70s, early 80s, like the craziness or the fad that was, or the fear or the phobia.
Hysteria is the word you're looking
for. Yes, the cult hysteria or the occult hysteria of the day. Again, go back to the West of Memphis or their Memphis Trio The True Detective Season 1. If you don't believe me, they tell you as well. And that was a literal hysteria with a lot of religious forces.
And Mustafa Akkad.
Hyping that up.
Mustafa Akkad, Malick's father, the original producer of the first film, was the one that adamantly wanted Michael Myers to be Halloween.
Right.
They brought him back in 4 for that reason. So they do have a deep care about this franchise. It's basically their baby, but they lose out the battle here.
To me, Ferens is trying to make a cult-centered movie, right? And then Weinstein's like, no, I bought a Michael Myers stomps around killing people.
Exactly what happened. So basically the theatrical cut was that it was the studio and the director ended up preferring, though the director was kind of in the middle during this, what eventually would be a legal battle. Malick Akkad said this was the first Halloween film they produced, which he felt there was major studio interference due to the lack of autonomy throughout the process. He cites that the Weinsteins were very hands-on, all the way from casting down to script revisions, and finally put their foot down on the theatrical cut being the preferred one and the one that would get the wide release as far as the explanation hidden or given within that film. Tensions actually got so high that the Akkads filed for an injunction to prohibit the release of the theatrical cut. They wanted to have that producer's cut be the only one seen and the only one known as this movie, but they talked to their lawyers and cooler heads eventually prevailed, so they backed off and the Weinsteins were able to release their film because the Weinsteins had no intention of backing down anyway. It's almost like Harvey Weinstein wasn't going to hear the word no.
It's true. I'm going to try to go get past that. Because, loaded joke there. But here's the thing. They kept control over this franchise after this film because H2O is the next movie in the chronological timeline, or at least in the years there.
And H2O
that comes
was
out.
Handled with care. So it's not like Miramax was totally.
Miramax has made a ton of good movies over the years. So
I don't know what happened with this one and why they thought this cut was the one to go on. So Akkad, finally, just to wrap up the preface here, goes on to explain that he wasn't happy with the theatrical cut. He doesn't like to be critical of the film because, quote, the hardest thing in the world to do is to create, and the easiest thing to do is criticize. That's a little jab at us. And then he went on to criticize Halloween 6 some more. So I don't know what happened there.
So nobody's allowed to criticize this terrible movie that I made.
Sure.
We're in charge of this. We fucked it up thoroughly. But nobody's allowed to criticize it because it's so much easier to criticize.
Exactly. That's how I read it, too. But this basically broke down to a WWE-type storyline, because all things come back to pro wrestling. The Weinsteins on one side, the Akkads on the other, and the director, Dan Ferris, was with the Akkads, and the director here was kind of stuck in the middle as to where to go. Malick Akkad, and this is all coming from Malick's side. The Weinsteins didn't pass comment. Malick Akkad says that basically the Weinsteins took the director to shoot stuff without the Akkads knowing, and that made the final cut and blah blah blah, this huge story. And when everyone that knows anything about Hollywood can tell you, the more trying and dramatic the shoot and the lead up, the pre-production process, the more not great that the movie usually
that
is.
That makes sense. So all right, so let's finally talk about it.
Premise. This is one of my favorites, by the way. It's one of my personal favorites, but it's not.
You're talking about the producer's cut.
I am, and it is, there are big differences. But again, even the producer's cut, not a great movie.
Okay, but it's your favorite for awesomely bad reasons, sure. So we'll talk about some of that. You want to read the premise here, Mike?
Yeah, we'll talk about IMDb. 6 years after Michael Myers last terrorized Haddonfield, he returns there in pursuit of his niece, Jamie Lloyd, who has escaped with her newborn child, for which Michael and a mysterious cult have sinister plans.
All right, so we start in the Man in Black cult.
The Cult of the Thorn.
The Cult of the Thorn. Hallways, grungy hallways, where we have the best hall monitor in the history of hall monitors, Michael Myers, roaming around. We have the birth.
Get to class.
Jamie Lloyd gives birth to this child. No mention is made of who's the father. Is it an incest baby with Michael? Is it the Man in Black? Who cares?
Right.
It makes no sense. So we have a midwife, blonde woman, who's kind of coaching her along the birth process. Then the midwife takes the baby away. A couple scenes later, all of a sudden, melodramatically, without cause, again, that's
save
the terminology.
Your baby.
She saves this baby for Jamie, who just gave birth, and she's like, all right, win a foot race with the rest of the cult, but that's the best she could do.
You would think the Cult of the Thorn would have a more stringent background check about who they have as their midwife for... Yeah. Killing this ultimate sacrifice.
Yeah, you would think that this the midwife would be the most loyal.
Right, right. Not like
most,
a questionable...
The most brainwashed.
Let's hire her, Jim. I got a feeling.
By far the most brainwashed woman is the midwife, the one
that
transferring
the baby. That has to take care of the baby, yeah.
There's Man in Black does this blood on the baby's belly ceremony.
It's a real baby, by the way. It looked pretty gnarly.
Yeah, well, he puts his finger in blood and makes the sign of the thorn on the baby's belly, and then that's where the transfer has a problem, and she basically gives it to Jamie Lloyd, who just had a baby, who has to escape now. Apparently, they have only one hall monitor, and it's Michael Myers.
Mm-hmm.
So the midwife gets killed. Gets thrown into a spike.
Pretty
Michael
cool
does
impalement
that.
Scene. And also all the blood and grotesque. And, yeah, all the blood and grotesqueness is very Weinstein-induced.
Yeah, it's fine. It makes some sense that it's grosser and gnarly, but it just goes so fast. It's just like, there's Michael. Boom, there's a spike. Boom, there's her head into the spike.
Problem, I agree.
So the editing is so jagged and so fast.
Jarring. It makes no sense at times.
All right, so now there's another Strode family. We meet Kara Strode. She apparently is the daughter of this big jerk of a abusive man.
It's the 90s, and we're just casually showing a father backhanding his daughter across the mouth and making
so
a bleed.
The daughter has a bastard child, again, with very little significance on the plot. Just the daughter has a bastard child.
Because Tommy was a child once, you see. So now we have Danny, who's a child.
All right, Danny also has telepathic connections.
He hears voices. He's supposed to be the one that the cult plague gets passed to.
It's like a seed that was planted that is trodden upon and never grows up.
Zero explanation, zero insight as to how this works, zero insight on what it has to do with Michael.
The thing I hate about this movie the most is that Tommy Doyle, Paul Rudd, lives across the street. He spies on the Myers house.
Yes.
He spies on the women there. Like, obviously, there's women there. There's
total creep.
The girlfriend, he's total creep. And Kara somehow allows for this to happen. Doesn't immediately hate this guy or doesn't immediately think he's a creep. They become like this surrogate family later on. But the hero of the story is a stalker.
Not likable.
He's an ogler.
Yeah.
He is a peeping Tom. He is a conspiracy theorist. He is a stay alone in a room creep.
It's basically Alex Jones. Yeah.
Ugh. Like, what are we doing?
Yeah, not a likable protagonist. That's for
played
sure.
By someone who looks like Paul Rudd.
Right.
So as long as he looks like Paul Rudd, it's okay.
Good looks are all that matters, man.
Like, how many serial killers were good looking?
Yeah.
A bunch of them. What was
Ted
the big
Bundy.
One?
Was
Ted
the,
Bundy.
Yeah, he was like.
He's a good looking guy. But
dashing gentleman.
Ugh. H.H. Holmes, too. I just listened to that last podcast on the left.
Oh, yeah. He was
supposedly
guy
a dashing man back in the whatever days.
One adjective we don't have to ever worry about being described as.
Dr. Loomis, also in town, also listens to the same hokey radio show.
I didn't mind Tommy that. They're actually proving that Michael Myers is a big deal. There's a substantiation
that
from
makes
all
some
this
sense.
Fear.
Makes some sense. So let's blow it out and have all the Halloween festivals we can. And let's have the creepy conspiracy theorist radio show host the festival. And why does he give a strip tease later on at that festival?
Because
that's
he's a shock
gimmick?
Jock.
That's a shock.
What year did Private Parts come out? I guarantee you it had to do with Howard Stern being naked on the cover of Private Parts. Oh, no. Parts came out in 97.
They had a false scare in mind so that he was supposedly looking like the Man in Black, even though the Man in Black is obviously an old man who walks very slow. And this is a little dweeb of a guy who walks very fast. And so we know based on so he's in the trench coat. And then, of course, give me a break. So none of it works. Nothing so far in this movie works, and that continues to be a trend. So Tommy befriends Kara and her son, scaring the son into dropping a pumpkin.
That's an homage, you see.
Somehow before this, Tommy gets wise to the fact, I don't know, you got to explain this to me. Tommy gets wise to the fact that Jamie escapes.
Yes.
In the truck because with the baby.
Jamie calls into the radio show that Tommy's listening to. And Tommy is able to isolate the audio from that radio. You should have paid attention because it's glorious. He's able to isolate the audio through all that 1990s technology that, of course, he has in his room at his disposal. Because it was you could have bought it easily. It definitely wasn't out of anyone's price range at the time. And he figures out on the recording, because he recorded the entire program, so he's able to play it back. He figures out on the recording that Jamie was at the bus depot. So he goes to the bus depot just to take a look around and finds her baby.
All right, so they set the best hall monitor in the world loose from the cult domain into Haddonfield yet again. He basically goes home. He goes to the Strode house, which we later find out that Uncle Strode couldn't sell.
He's a real estate.
So they just held on to it, but it had all this history that he never told his Strode family members that we don't know or care about, really, other than the fact that they're abused by
him. You did an awesome job. You're right on with how you should feel about the theatrical cut.
So again, Tommy befriends the little boy, Danny, which is super creepy. And
it's an homage, you see.
Kara comes home to it, and Kara's like, get away from him! which is the most honest reaction in this whole goddamn movie. But then they're best friends a minute later because she realizes he is a baby, so he must be okay. Oh, my God. So Tommy.
Bad men don't hold babies.
But here's another thing. You should have been another 14 red flags, because later on, Tommy takes Kara and Danny to his apartment across the street.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's the stronghold. It's across the street.
Yeah. Well, he's got to be able to spy still. It's in his blood.
Ugh. So he's telling her all of the Samhain Cult of the Thorn.
But there's very little exposition explanation. Dump. There's much more in the producer's cut. I'll talk about the differences when we wrap up here.
The sacrifice of one family means the survival of the entire tribe. And that's Paul Rudd's delivery. I think that's why these people are after Jamie's baby, to make it Michael's final sacrifice.
Hey, nobody knows that anyone's after Jamie's baby. He has no idea.
I'm the only man who can stop him before it's too late.
Gotta go. And then he leaves.
So you can take care of the baby, right? Let me go just lurk around this Halloween festival. And on the off chance that Michael will kill some people.
Show up there.
Put them in the foliage. Why aren't they laying low, Michael?
Well, those three milk cans aren't going to hit themselves with the softball at the festival.
Oh, my God. It's so dumb. I forgot to mention that Jamie.
Jamie, who has at this point been brutally murdered.
Jamie, by some, could be sensed as either a hero or a horrifying victim in the last two movies. We have two movies worth of credence built into her character, and Michael does the most sadistic kill of the entire series with whatever that lawns-keeping device is. I don't know tools, but it's like a double chainsaw. What is that thing?
Oh, it's the
hedge giant clipper?
The hell it is, yeah.
There's two big giant spiky hedge clippers or something.
Corn shearer, I don't know.
Shears. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, we don't fucking know what we're talking about. So essentially, Michael kills Jamie in the most gory kill of the series.
Which is totally different from the producer's cut again, but yeah, that was included and she was off relatively early in this.
All right, so Loomis and Wynn, Man in Black, he turns out to be the Man in Black, spoiler alert. They're on the hunt for the baby and Jamie, right?
Yes.
So they meet up with Tommy at the hospital, and Tommy's like, of course, he has no people skills. He's like, I found this baby! Help me! 911! You don't have to call 911, sir. You're already here. You don't have to call out. No, it's just so dumb. But Loomis is like, I like the way you speak! Yeah, boy, after my own heart. And then and he's like, where did you get that baby from? And of course, Tommy's like, I think this is the last of the long line of Strodes. And Loomis is like, yes, I sensed it. The evil in his eyes.
It's funny because it's pretty much exactly how this conversation goes.
I don't know
goes.
What's happening. So Michael basically haunts the Strode house at that point, kills the mother Strode, who's a nice mom.
For no explanation, but yep.
Kills the father when he comes over, kills the brother.
Gruesome father death.
The brother explodes. With the girlfriend, and the brother says the most ridiculous things. Oh, we just had sex. Oh, I got a shower, babe, because you're so fucking gross. What is he saying there?
I feel disgusted.
I got to keep fresh. And of course, she drops a line on him. Beware of the boogeyman. Yeah. Like, come on.
Not to mention, they're only there because the shock jock DJ was supposed to take the radio show to the Myers house. And so they get there first to the Myers house. The shock jock ends up getting killed by Michael in the van.
Right.
So he never makes it. But they're expecting the radio DJ to come to their house. And they're like, oh, you think he'll come?
Yeah.
I don't know. You want to have sex? Yeah.
And he's like the biggest phone dick ever. So that's his cardinal sin,
yeah,
the
he
shock
calls
jock.
Michael a pussy. Yeah.
And then the two bimbos who have sex, they have sex, but they're also really dumb. And they're saying, you know what? Their sin, their fatal sin is god-awful banter. So the two of us are going to be dead at the end of this episode. And
whatever.
Those two idiot bimbos, terrible banterers, are dead.
If this is your way of asking me to sleep with you, I won't do it. So basically, Michael enters the house after Tim and Beth have sex, and Michael kills them both.
And he telepathically sends for Danny, right?
Right.
So Danny goes over there. Kara follows him.
Kara knows Michael's there because Kara watched him kill Beth.
She's freaking out. So Tommy's coming home just at
Tommy's weird
the same time.
Yeah.
Luckily, he's coming home at the same time. Michael basically hunts Danny and Kara. Kara gets a weapon, gets away
actually
from Michael.
Fights him.
It's fine. Tommy and Loomis all show up at the party at the same time because they're all figuring it out at the same time. It's dumb. And the cult is there as well. So Loomis lures Wynn. We find that the man in black is Dr. Wynn,
the big
other
reveal,
old guy.
The big reveal is that Wynn turns out to be the man in black. Mrs. Blankenship, who you think is this harmless old lady, is a member of the cult. All these druids come out of nowhere. And essentially, they take Kara. They drug Tommy and Loomis without us seeing anything like that.
Now, so of course...
He comes back. I feel like I've been drugged. You have been drugged.
So Kara knows... there's the two most ridiculous things in the whole movie that are pretty funny. There's that where the worst, make
no explanation, no showing of what happened.
It's almost like it should have been done in like a puppet voice. Like, I feel like I've been drugged. You have been drugged.
Like, how do we get
like they could
separate
really...
Kara from Loomis and Tommy at this point?
Like, how did Donald
just
Pleasance...
say they were drugged? Beautiful.
How did Donald Pleasance say okay to this?
This was his last one. He had to know he was dying.
He was like, I am going to be dead any second.
We got to wrap filming because I'm dying.
He was going to be dead soon. And he just had no fight left in him.
I don't blame him. What good God.
Is he okayed that?
Yeah. And the worst part is that stays in the producer's cut. I don't even have a defense for it.
All right, so that was bad. But also Kara, she knew there was a cult running around. So instead of being handcuffed by them, or she thought she was going to die, she jumps out a closed window.
Through the window, yes.
And then the very next scene,
they're taken away.
It's Paul Rudd and Loomis over the spot where she left. And they're like,
whoa. Feel like I've been drugged.
Dude, are you seeing the shit that I'm seeing right now? Are there 7 baby deer in that tree? Are they neon for you too? And Loomis is like, yes, I see the daughter of the devil in the tree.
Loomis is getting like CPR done on him. Just like, gotta finish the shot, Donnie.
Oh my
so
God.
Anyway, we got the big third act in the theatrical cut takes place at Smith's Grove. We're going back to Smith's Grove because, of course, Loomis just magically knows where they want to do their final act. That's literally the explanation we're given.
So, yeah, the mental hospital. Again, great hall monitoring by Michael Myers until the hall monitor that cannot be controlled turns on the faculty. Because after...
For reasons.
For reasons. No reason. After Loomis busts in and has a showdown in Glenn's office, because he knows where Glenn's office is.
Immediately. Then why'd you drug him?
They bop him on the head again.
Yeah.
It's just so tough.
If Loomis was a Madden character, his awareness in this movie would be like, it alternate between a 99 and a 40.
Why would the cult drug him only to get him back and then bop him on the head?
That's my question. I don't
know. Because of the ending for the producer's cut, I would imagine.
No, the producer's cut has a lot of major differences, but I feel like I've been drugged scene, and then the scene where Loomis just says, I know where this is taking place, and the meeting in the office with Wynn is in the producer's cut.
Anyway.
It's indefensible.
It's fucking aggravating because you get a damsel in distress again. Kara wakes up and dressed in all white. Tommy's got to save her. The only kind of good thing about Paul Rudd's acting is that he's like laughing while Michael Myers is walking up to him as he's breaking through. They're courageous. I give him credit for that. Of course, there is a room with a lot of green goo in it. So again, Halloween 3 influence. I don't know if it's embalming fluid for all the fetuses in the mental hospital.
No explanation. There was never an allusion or any kind of reference to any green goo throughout this.
It's the secret of the ooze Terminator. Not Terminator. Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 there. And, or 3 maybe.
He injects Mike when he becomes Super
Shredder. So, of course, Paul Rudd will find a bunch of syringes or shots and fill it with goo and then stab Michael Myers with it, who doesn't fall over
yet.
Has no effect on him any time he does it. So it makes no sense. I mean, Michael Myers is probably like, it's embalming fluid. It's not...
Why are you doing this to me?
It doesn't mean anything.
It's like ecto-cooler high C. Delicious.
This is a wonderful placebo. I feel more energized.
Yeah.
Well, whatever. Paul Rudd somehow gets the upper hand on him after Michael fights Kara and he beats the shit out of him.
Yeah, and the green goo comes out of Michael's nose. They leave in probably the worst edited scene of the movie. That fight happens. Cut to Paul Rudd is in the car with Kara and Tommy, and they just leave.
And now Dr. Loomis is like, I can't leave. I'm going to, I have some one more.
I have some business to attend to here.
I have one more thing to do. And then they cut into the mental hospital hallways, and he's just going, it's like a scream taken from another Loomis of another movie.
Yeah, because we see only Michael's mask on the ground, meaning he's escaped.
And killing Loomis.
No.
Well, Loomis is screaming. It's supposed to be
that Loomis is screaming because Michael is gone. It's not, it has nothing to, that scream is from the producer's cut. So it's got nothing to do with this theatrical version. They just added it in.
I thought it was, Loomis was dying. That seemed like a death-curdling scream.
Fine with me.
Either way, it's just so unclear and it's just so anticlimactic. Like
reason I say it's for Michael leaving is because in the producer's cut, that's why he screams, because he realized Michael's gone.
I wonder if Donald Pleasance actually died and they didn't want to show him dying and then dedicate the movie to him. Michael finally killing him.
Oh, that could be. But they have an explanation. It's not a good one, but there's a different explanation in the producer's cut. Just to go through some of the biggest difference of the producer's cut is basically a completely different film. Even the opening monologue is even different. It's Loomis reciting the opening monologue, not Tommy. It's given more emphasis. It's the setup. We actually have a follow-up to Jamie and see that she was accosted by the man in black at the end of Halloween 5 and not just randomly showing up here when Tommy says, oh, I think they've been missing for 6 years, but I think someone's been hiding them.
Yeah.
And it's heavily implied that Jamie herself hears the voice as Danny does later in the film. The exposition is probably the biggest difference. It's the most inclusive and important stuff that's in this producer's cut. It's just not anywhere in the theatrical cut. Tommy explains that Michael is interested in taking out Kara and the Strohs because to Michael, whoever lives in his house is family. So that's his motivation. It's not great, but at least it's there. What the extra scenes do most effective is explaining the supernatural tie-ins. They go into a little more detail about what the Cult of Thorn is, how it ties into Michael's past filmography with all his kills. So again, not good stuff, but there's at least more there. And the third act is totally different. The third act takes place, not that surgical scene, the goo, the green ooze, not in the producer's cut at all.
So one thing we didn't talk about was Michael, after they're preparing the sacrifice of this infant child. Number one, if you have bad guys who are supposed to be kind of cool, like Michael Myers,
right,
like people kind of like Michael Myers, even in a sick way,
yeah. You
can't make him do something so unforgivable. You can't assassinate his character. Like if Hannibal Lecter just killed babies
right. And
didn't kill assholes,
right. Then
I mean, up till now, Michael Myers kills assholes for the most part. Once he's trying to kill a baby, you're like, ugh.
Yeah.
So the character totally assassinates himself. So here you have Michael Myers. All right, he kills all of the doctors and all of the cult members who are going to kill the baby here. So now is this the Weinstein saying what I just said, that principle of Michael Myers can't be trying to kill a baby?
Well, Maybe.
It's a ham-handed way to do it.
I don't think either cut really handles Michael Myers well at all. And first of all, he's not really the big bad. The big bad is, like, Wynn. Michael's basically reduced to a henchman role in this movie, regardless of cut. And the producer's cut makes it pretty clear that Michael impregnated Jamie. Like, it's not all good stuff in the producer's cut. They make it pretty obvious. It's heavily implied that Michael impregnated Jamie and the baby is Michael's, so he's just trying to kill his own kid now. It's not handled extremely well. And it actually gives him a cop-out because he turns on people because he does realize it's his baby for a moment there in the producer's cut. It's basically, the producer's cut ends with Tommy having magical rocks, believe this or not, making a circle. Michael can't get out of it because it's something to do with the Cult of Thorn.
Yeah.
Loomis comes upon Michael, who's supposed to be dead at one point, and it turns out that Michael had switched clothing with Wynn. So Loomis finds Michael, turns out it's Wynn, and Michael is seen walking off in the Man in Black's costume.
So here's where I land on this. This felt like the worst student film of the class. This felt like the student film where people got shots that they didn't know what to do with, where they kind of wrangled the script together. And everybody remembers the film class where they had to suffer through all of the short films made by your classmates.
Right.
And this was the one where the filmmaker actually had to say, well, because she was dead the whole time. You know, because don't you get it? Don't
Quiet
you get it?
Shyamalan. You'll never make it in this business.
This is ridiculous. So that's how I feel about Halloween 3. Like, you explained all the shit to me that I just, like, zoned out. Some of it I zoned out for it. Yeah,
it's excusable. This is not, whether it's producer's cut or the theatrical version, the film is not good. Certainly the most enriching part of this movie is the backstory leading up to it. It is quite interesting to see when a studio basically collapses within itself and fights for rights. It leads to a messy film 99 times out of 100, and that was the case here as well. Again, it's a personal favorite of mine, just because I at least, the producer's cut at least tries, like, A for effort, D minus for execution. Yeah. It at least tries to tie in everything and make this cinema world building type deal that we so badly want as movie fans. So I give him a lot of credit for that. The theatrical cut, I think, was just a money grab, and I don't really have a lot of respect for it.
I will be honest with you. The theatrical cut of The Curse of Michael Myers is one of the worst movie watching experiences I've had all year.
I want to, like, fight that. I can't. I hadn't seen the theatrical cut until yesterday when I watched it for the first time. Yeah. It's awful. It's incomprehensible.
I think I'm like a savvy movie watcher at this point. I've seen like 100,000 of them. So he should be by now. And I just can't.
Give a take.
I can't focus on it.
It's not
number one. And then number two is, like, when I do focus on it, I'm just like, ugh, ugh, ugh.
But wait, there's more.
Halloween Resurrection.
Listen. Halloween 6 has a special place in my heart, and it has the exact opposite place that Halloween Resurrection has in my colon. I hate this movie with a passion. We will try to get through this respectfully.
I don't like it much myself. All right, so cast and crew directed by Rick Rosenthal, who directed Halloween 2. He's an award-winning producer on Transparent, and we bioed him earlier in that H2 profile there. Written by Larry Brand and Sean Hood.
Would have been better if it was written by Larry Bird.
Larry Brand wrote the unfamous 2013 movie The Girl on the Train, which is not the famous novel adaptation there.
Huh.
Hood is known from 2011's Conan the Barbarian, remembers. Not The Rock, it was the one with
Khal Drogo.
The movie stars Jamie Lee Curtis for an opening sequence that pissed me off so much. I'm glad she's reprising the role again to make sure that this nonsense never happened.
It did never happen. This movie doesn't exist.
Right. Brad Laurie plays Michael Myers. He's best known for his stunt work on X2, Shanghai Noon, and The Watchmen. Busta Rhymes is Freddie Harris. He's a longtime MC, of course. Busta's acting career somehow didn't begin with this movie. I like some songs of his back in the day. He is a terrible actor.
It's infuriating because in Narc, he's actually not terrible.
Right. Narc, I remember he's okay. Finding Forrester is another movie he's in. Shaft, I never seen.
I haven't seen Shaft yet. I
did see Shaft. I don't remember a minute. I did see Shaft, though, back in the day.
He's offensive in this.
He's so bad, and the director doesn't help him. They actually linger on him, like, just nodding after he does a shot. Like, yeah, nod. Like, what is wrong with them?
I'm angry.
Oh, my goodness. So Bianca...
That's what I'm talking about?
Bianca Kojlich, I'm killing that word, I'm sorry, is Sarah. She's from Bring It On, 10 Things I Hate About You in 30 Minutes or Less. Apparently, she needs to be the protagonist because she's the whitest girl in the movie. Also, the blandest.
Yeah, that's about right.
Does that make any sense? Why does she deserve protagonist? Why is she the protagonist? What earns her the right? What behavior does she exhibit in this movie that makes her... This is why they give the movie away to Busta Rhymes and all the other side characters.
She has a palm pilot.
Because she is a wet carrot. I mean, she's a beautiful girl, and she is a terrible actress. I'm not going to try to make sure...
She's got a stylus pen. That's why.
What reason?
Technologically inclined.
For what reason is she the protagonist?
There is not. There's why did this...
You have better actors than the rest of this cast.
Oh, yeah,
you
that's a good point.
Sean Patrick Thomas is best known from Save the Last Dance, which as rom-coms from that age, tween directed rom-coms. That was a decent movie.
Certainly,
I mean, everybody get mad at me but I remember watching that movie and liking that
movie. I would watch Save the Last Dance before I watch this again.
Yeah. Absolutely. He's also in Barbershop. He's also in Cruel Intentions. A lot of good 90s movies, mm-hmm. vintage 90s movies. 3,000 Miles to Graceland's Daisy McCracken is Donna. Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica. Katie Sackhoff is Jen in this movie.
Everybody loves her.
I love her. I watched all of those, like the Portlandia skit.
Yeah.
Lost my job. Everything happened. Boom, boom. I can't stop binge watching Battlestar Galactica. That was like 4 years ago. That was an epic binge watch that I did. So just out of control fast.
See, there's some positives from this review.
It might have been a low point in my life, but it's funny because it's a Portlandia skit where the two of them watch and they lose their job. They get their house foreclosed upon. It's everything happens because it's a good show. She was in Riddick, Oculus, very underrated horror movie there. Longmire and 24. Again, that's Katie Sackhoff.
Yeah, she was a sweetheart of that late 90s, early 2000s. Yeah,
we have Rookie of the Years and American Pie's Thomas Ian Nicholas. It's another sweetheart. He plays Bill. And of course, Tyra Banks.
Yeah.
Not a great actress, I will admit, but a very charismatic
personality. I'd watch her do a one-woman replay of Othello before I gave another role to Busta Rhymes.
She's Nora. So you have charismatic personalities, but it's just such a dive bomb of a movie here.
Specs, directed by Rick Rosenthal, produced by Paul Freeman, screenplay Larry Brand and Sean Hood, story by Larry Brand as well. It's based on, again, the characters from Deborah Hill and John Carpenter. Critical reception, we're up to a 19! Metascore is a 19, almost doubling that of Halloween 6. IMDb score 4.1 out of 10 on 31,000 votes. Rotten Tomatoes score is 12%, 3.3 out of 10 average critic score. Only 7 fresh reviews out of 60. It's getting worse. Audience give it a 26%. I think that's even lower than Halloween 6 had that we just talked about. 2.8 out of 5 average audience score on 90,000 reviews. Produced by Dimension Films. Again, though, the Weinsteins are holding tight there. This one came out after H2O. Don't forget, we already covered H2O in a separate movie, so we have, again, a history of Dimension Films handling this property with care. And then they put this one out. Nightfall Productions, Trancus International Films, also produced production companies listed, distributed by Dimension. Came out in the summer, July 12th, 2002. Kind of an awkward spot for a horror movie. The middle of summer there, running time 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
$13 million budget. Again, this one turned a profit. If you're going to make movies, make horror movies, I guess. $37.6 million. Domestically, a little over $30 million. Foreign market brought in a little over $7 million. That's where the breakdown comes. Again, almost three times the listed production budget, so you think it's in the black overall.
Yeah, and it's a film that's coming off of H2O.
Right.
That made a lot of good money.
Which basically revitalized the franchise.
80-something million off of a like $12 million budget. The numbers were something like that.
There's proof that people still want to see Michael Myers.
It made crazy money. Now, this makes a little bit of money, maybe made $10 million for Dimension Films, which they'll take, I'm sure.
Sure.
Basically, you have H2O ending with Jamie Lee Curtis cutting off the head of Michael Myers. Now, leading up to that point, we have vintage Michael Myers stuff. She runs him over with a car.
Yes.
He does the Undertaker rise from the dead.
Yes.
We're supposed to believe that another guy... who Michael Myers put the mask on instead of him after Michael Myers was killed.
Yeah.
It was all confusing. And then they're like, well, why couldn't the security guards identify the situation? And they show Michael Myers crushing his larynx. They should have had this should have been a comedy. Because they should have said, well, why didn't he write down what happened? Because Michael crushed his fingers. Well, why did he? They could just keep going.
He took his eyelids. He couldn't blink.
They could have kept doing that. Why didn't he say one for yes and two for no?
Now,
because he smashed his head in.
If you want to take the stance that this was a different filmmaker. They were just trying to get money. They didn't prepare for the ending of H2O. It's not their fault. That's one thing. But Jamie Lee Curtis signed on for two pictures when she signed on for H2O. They knew they were making a sequel to H2O, and yet they went with the head chopping off incident to end H2O at the behest of Jamie Lee Curtis. So they knew they were going to have to retcon it at some point, somehow. They had basically, 5 years to do this? 3 years to do this after H2O? And this is the best they came up with, that Michael switched someone when people weren't watching. What?
And Jamie Lee Curtis essentially cut off the head of an innocent man.
Right.
Makes no sense. Who was in a body bag that raised from the dead.
Yeah.
That wasn't really dead.
Right.
Obviously.
And survived. Going down a hill, flying through the windshield, getting hit, getting pinned against the steel beam, reaching out for Jamie. Please, God, kill me.
He was muted. Probably
begging for it.
Of course, he was muted. Yeah, all the stuff that Michael Myers did, because it was Michael Myers in H2O, and they wrote like
again. That's why H2O. Take these in a vacuum. Six and this one, they have nothing to do with the series. This one didn't happen.
Couple of brief production nuggets. Principal photography was Vancouver, British Columbia. Began in May 14, 2001. Again, that opening scene was filmed during H2O's. They actually recorded the scenes where Michael Myers killed somebody in the hallway there and back
during the filming of H2O.
Yeah, during the filming of H2O. Mustafa Akkad, the producer, wouldn't allow the writers to kill off Michael Myers, and of course Jamie Lee Curtis wanted to push for it so bad, like you said. So resurrection premise here, Michael.
Yeah, premise is listed on IMDb. 3 years after he last terrorized his sister, so we're 3 years out from H2O, Michael Myers confronts her again before traveling to Haddonfield to deal with the cast and crew of a reality show. My God, I'm getting angry just reading this, which is being broadcast from his old home.
You know it's trendy now, Mike. Reality shows.
My God,
you know it's trendy fan footage type of stuff. You know it's trendy Doom the video game. or was it GoldenEye at this point?
So I think it's the Sinister Cinema Reviews. It's the guy I'm borrowing from. He made the point, and I remember thinking this back in 2002 when I watched this movie in theaters and thought it should be titled Halloween Resurrection when Mike 1 almost gave up hope. MTV at the time had a television show called Fear.
Right.
And what they would do was take participants, because they were in the big cutting edge of this reality stuff. They would take participants and put them in these supposedly haunted places and have them stay overnight and film themselves staying overnight.
Got it. So
and if they were able to do it, they win money.
Right. Got it.
So I think this is a direct take from that MTV show. I'm pretty sure that was the inspiration and all the forethought that went into this script.
It's not a lot of forethought.
Now, that said,
yeah,
the opening 20 minutes, that Jamie Lee Curtis's involvement, I know you have issues with it. If this was a short film just involving Jamie Lee Curtis' confrontation with Michael and Michael finally kills her, I have much less of a problem with this movie.
Yeah, I like the fact that Michael breaks in, she gets a jump on him. I like the fact that she's being silent for all those years, paralleling his life in a mental hospital.
Right.
I like that. All right, I mean, she's like basically so stubborn.
And she spent 3 years waiting
willful.
For him.
Yeah, I mean, that's she's so willful that
Which is why this remake, this 2018 remake, is everyone's so excited for.
Right.
She's been preparing.
We know she's a willful protagonist.
Right.
We know she would take a vow of silence and prepare for
why not?
Killing
she's
Michael.
Been through all
not
that
take
shit.
Her meds. And yeah, all that stuff is good. Obviously, the security guard who's eating some ring-dings at the vending machine, you know, for him to die just for eating some ring-dings, it turned me off of this movie.
Have
right
you no shame, Michael?
I was very upset about that, because sometimes you need a late-night snack. What's wrong with that?
You don't have to sell me.
He had some hostess goodness there, and boom, he's a little chubby, let himself go a little bit, not going to the gym as much. I feel bad for this guy.
Are you okay?
He can't move around as well.
This isn't really about the
security. He sweats when he's not supposed to sweat. And he eats what he's not supposed to eat. And that sin alone kills this man.
He has a seat at our table anytime.
It's a little hefty. And a poor guy. It's all right. So Michael kills him brutally.
Yeah.
He's like, the guy has to find like a head in a washing machine. Again, from another movie. That I think it was the last movie.
Would Michael be successful in any other town in America where there is at least one capable government employee in some sector?
Yeah, it's just so dumb. Like, this whole thing. And why would they allow that other mental patient to just be obsessed?
Walking around the grounds.
Walking around the grounds, yes. But also obsessed with all the reading materials about serial murderers.
I'm like, sure this won't come back to bite us in the ass at any time.
Hey, let him have whatever reading materials he wants. Yeah. He wants to study John Wayne Gacy? Let him go.
Get him a clown mask.
Get him the clown mask. Let that little boy do his thing. It's the most ridiculous thing. Yeah, why would they stupid. Give...
It's stupid. And I mean, if you want to nitpick Laurie's setup for Michael, too, like how her grand plan involved Michael stepping into this foot-wide rope.
Right, just in case I can get him in this six-inch yeah. little rope, I'm sure I'll get him to stand right where I need him to stand.
It's a pretty obvious
And then
complaint.
I just hate what Laurie does. Like, she's got to take the mask off. Fine, I get that.
Yeah, I'm okay with that,
she
too,
doesn't
because of
kill
the
somebody.
Retcon.
But let me, with both of his hands ready, let me try and reach
get
there.
Get within arm's length.
Let me, yeah. arms length. Of course he's going to snatch yeah. and grab you. Of course. It's the most absurd thing I've ever seen.
But all that said, I'm glad she died and was not part of the
rest of the movie.
Reprehensible script and execution that came up for the rest of the, this is just, Busta Rhymes does not get to live. Why?
Here's the thing though. Busta Rhymes is by far the most likable character in the rest of this movie. Like, he has...
Oh, I disagree.
Why do we have to even disagree?
Yeah, think he's likable?
Because he has the kung fu thing. He's the one putting on this fake reality show.
He's
he has the most
shit
agency.
To Michael the whole time.
Yeah, he's talking shit to Michael, but he has Tyra Banks on his side. He's a bad character and a bad actor, but he's better than Sexual Harassment Magoo and Sexual Harassment McGee and every single male character in the rest of this movie. And every female character is just like a bunch of sixth graders back in the 90s where everybody was a fucking disgusting human being.
Ugh.
Right? Because everybody is just...
What's wrong with Katie Sackhoff?
Well, she's just like brushing off all the sexual harassment and then...
She's getting harassed.
Playing to the... I'm gonna flash the camera. She's playing along with it. Like, and then the other girl is being sexually harassed by the creepiest guy in the world and then that turns her on? Like, it's like written by a bunch of disgusting, creepy men.
Yeah. There is a huge problem with the characters.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And all of it. It's just gross. So essentially, Busta Rhymes... Here's the plot. Busta Rhymes sets up a fucking reality show about the old Myers house where he planted all these props and he was going to dress up as Michael Myers and fake scare all these kids to make it like a reality show, but it's not Michael Myers. Of course, Michael Myers, after he kills Laurie Strode, doesn't dissipate like a Jedi. He, in fact, comes back to his old Myers house and he just wants to live. He can finally live the rest of his life in peace. No, with
kids.
All of his creepy dead dog, whatever, meat puppets.
Yeah, grinds the kids, kills them all one by one.
Here's the worst part of this. You have the chef character, the guy from Save the Last Dance, gets in there, and of course, the one accoutrement Michael Myers would have would be fresh fennel? What in the fuck is that about? What? This smells fresh. What the hell is that about?
He likes.
Michael likes to season his dead dog.
You can't just eat raccoon and squirrel.
Are we supposed to believe?
Have a little color there.
Are we supposed to believe it's a continuation of the curse of Michael Myers, and that's from the last family?
Look, man. I have no idea. This movie just angers me to no end.
All right, there's a few awesomely bad things in the beginning that I kind of liked. Number one, Haddonfield is this podunk little town with five cops for the whole series.
Yeah.
But there's a Haddonfield University.
Yeah.
Not a college, a university.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And you have a classroom with like 200 students in Haddonfield fucking University.
I cannot believe you put this much thought into this movie. Yeah, no, you're right. That's a great criticism.
It's the dumbest thing I've ever seen. This town is like smaller than the towns we live in.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes no sense.
The rest of this is just going to be me agreeing with you.
There's not a high school class that big.
No. You're absolutely right.
And there's, of course, not a college in either one of our podunk little towns.
No, not even close. It's barely a high school.
So I love the fact that the protagonist drives a moped, and I really love the fact that it gets the hardest rocking soundtrack of the entire film.
It's so stupid. Everything about this is so dumb. Why did we do this?
But even, all right, so all the male characters are disgusting. They say one disgusting thing after the other, except really for Busta Rhymes.
Right, that's
true. He does it. So by association, that's why I felt like he's a better character. But anyway, even the guy in the chair character, who's this freshman at a college who emails, and they do a long exposition. Yeah. A long exposition dump on the what emails are and how cool and snazzy they are.
You could text a Palm Pilot from a cell phone, apparently, back in 2002.
And, of course, he goes to a party, and you know what's really admirable to do at a party? These writers are fucking scum.
Commandeer They're the scum. Home computer system.
You know what? Who wrote this fucking movie? Scumbags. I hope they're powerful in Hollywood today,
so
too.
So we're not going to try.
I'll never get a job. They're fucking scumbags, because this is the character we're glorifying here. Uh-huh. Number one, we're allowing all this sexual harassment. The guy in the chair, Decker, is like this creepy guy who won't like interact at a party that he's at.
Right. He's got to watch this live feed.
Of this girl that he just like stalks over the internet.
Yeah, it's gross. But he's the hero.
He's the hero.
And she is no qualms. This is how catfishing became a thing. No qualms that when they meet in real life, they just embrace and they're in love.
What is it about her character that means anything to anybody?
That's admirable. You don't think she's a...
She doesn't have a characteristic. There's no dimensions to her character.
She's the least
gross. She
doesn't
have a flaw. She doesn't have a personality.
Yeah, you're right.
She's just... It's like Janie Briggs in Not Another Teen Movie has a personality. There's not one... Like, all I know about her is she has a moped. And she answers a question in class. And she doesn't want to look too revealing in that shirt that was super hot.
It's perfectly revealing.
And her girlfriends are like, oh my God, that's so hot. And they're correct.
This was rock bottom of all the horror franchises too, because the dialogue is terrible. It's all oversexed and oversold. This and Freddy vs. Jason came out around the same time. And it was just like, there was nothing here to analyze. You're absolutely
right. So Michael kills everybody in the house one by one. And number one, that house is a small house.
Yeah.
Like when you walk into a house and you're going to stay there the whole night.
Yeah.
Especially when you walk in there during the day. Like, wouldn't you just like take a lap around the house?
Well,
like,
they did.
They're discovering new rooms for the next 60 minutes of screen time and having sex in those rooms and sexually harassing each other in those rooms. It's gross. And it's dumb.
How happy I am that you're this fired up about this movie. It makes my job a lot easier because I have just nothing but contempt.
And there's the name Dangertainment.
Awful.
Isn't that the worst thing you ever heard? But here's even dumber. Like,
We said we were going to be nice about this movie.
Decker was gross for going in the back room to some father's office at this college party, which makes no fucking sense.
Yeah, commandeering the home computer system and spying on
this girl. It's a college party, isn't it?
Yeah.
So why are they at somebody's parents'
house?
No,
it's seniors. House? They're seniors. Because they've never been freshmen invited.
It's at some frat party. So they go into this room with a big screen TV and a computer. And of course, the projected computer
can be seen
by
everyone.
TV, because that's convenient. That has to happen. But I can barely do that now. Never mind in 1990. Fuck all.
Well, I'm glad you can, because I can't.
Right? I used to have Google Chrome. So this kid, not only does he creepily watch this internet feed stalking his internet girlfriend on this big screen TV, completely ignoring everybody else at the party, but everybody else at the party descends on him and watches it with him. Now he's cool.
Yeah. Could you imagine if you were at a party, like in college, you were getting drunk or high school, whatever you want to call it, and it was a Halloween party, and the highlight of the night was watching a live feed of a reality show where people were facing this serial killer, and the only thing you have to be convinced that these people are actually dying is the dweeb in the front that's commanding the mouse's word. Everyone else, at the outset, everyone thinks it's fake death, and then he's like, that actually just happened. Well, how do you know, you fuck? Who's who made you boss?
No, nobody knows.
There are some positives. The cinematography in this one is much better than an
editing
Halloween
makes
6.
Some sense. Yes. Yeah, I mean, it flows better. It's actually a movie quality production.
Right, you
values,
actually are watching a film.
I would say, yeah, I would agree with that.
And that's it.
That's it. No, the story is nonsense.
The story is garbage. The characters
and
are garbage.
Like Harvey Weinstein wrote this movie.
Michael's mask looks like Michael Jackson's face in this one. It looks like a bit feministic. not at all intimidating. It's like softer features. It's got like pouty lips. I don't know what the hell they were doing.
Yeah, the kills are kind of all gross again. All right, so we get a knife fight involved here, which was okay. But then, like, the characters you're rooting for, they die so helplessly that it's not okay.
And Busta Rhymes lives.
And yeah, and Busta Rhymes, the goofy character.
The guy who's been talking
shit. Who's watching kung fu movies.
Who has multiple encounters with Michael.
Yeah.
Gets to live.
And here's another. There's a room with water on the floor.
Yes.
Fire on the walls.
Sure is.
And electricity just out of control on wires throughout.
Currenting everywhere, yeah.
Currenting everywhere. What? All these conductors. I don't know a lot about science. I just know it's a room of death. And yet, the girl is able to, like, stop, drop, and roll her way out of the way of Michael. Yeah. Busta Rhymes is able to have a full few rounds of kung fu fighting mm-hmm. with Michael Myers. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, that's the fight we're dying to see. This
Busta Rhymes versus Michael.
Yeah, Busta Rhymes, because Busta Rhymes is a fighter of any. It would make sense if it was like a UFC fighter or a WWE guy. Right. If it was Stone Cold Steve Austin in a Halloween movie, maybe we'll be like, all right, it'd be kind of cool to see
Stone Cold.
That's
why The Rock works in Fast and Furious.
But
right.
You would use that character to lose to Michael Myers to raise up the profile of Michael Myers.
Uh-huh.
And then pose him against a courageous and yet untrained fighter.
An established protagonist, yes.
Right, but this is just like, no, Michael Myers is really bad, but Busta Rhymes is tough too.
That's why I hated it. Busta Rhymes is not that tough in real life.
No, and he's just a
And I say that knowing
fan.
That if I challenge Busta Rhymes to a fight, it'd probably kick my ass, but I can land a shot on Busta Rhymes.
Even if they actually put this in the plot and Busta Rhymes was fighting on a punching bag for the first 15 minutes of this movie and he was training and he had a Rocky montage, who the fuck cares about Busta Rhymes versus Michael Myers?
Echoing all
who
my
cares
sentiments.
About a rapper versus a movie monster?
No, not me.
Nobody.
Certainly not me and not you.
Why do we have to make him an action star? He doesn't want to be. Yeah, I don't think he even wanted to be.
This has been my biggest complaint about this for 15 years
so
now.
All you Busta Rhymes fans, it's great. Be Busta
all
Rhymes
fans.
All of them. Be Busta Rhymes fans. I liked some of his songs back in the day too, but you don't need, for your fandom, you don't need him to beat up Michael Myers.
Listen, we've done all the Halloween movies. We've had one out of, what, 7 or 8? That's just going to be relatively negative, and it was this one, and we had to do it.
This podcast.
We had to get it
rough.
Out of our system.
It was Eeyore and Oscar.
Yeah. I don't think Eeyore knows the F word, though. This was bad. And
Eeyore's rated G, and in 100 Acre Wood is rated G.
Right. We hope that we can at least steer you away
rated
from
R,
these
Winnie
movies.
The Pooh metaphor.
You can watch it for the awesome,
don't watch these
awesome
movies.
Badness, but yeah.
I watch every one of these movies twice or three times.
Yeah.
I tried to rewatch Resurrection last night, and I just shut it off. I was like, ugh,
yes.
I'm watching Jane Fonda in 5X, which was delightful, by the way.
Great, good. Well, it's a nice. So the moral of this story, watch Jane Fonda in 5X.
Yeah, HBO on demand. HBO Go. These movies sucked.
Well, this is the hardest one. Hopefully, God willing, we got the two zombie ones left, and then we're finally going to unleash the David Gordon Green.
I know people are down on the zombie movies, but at least there are movies that
at
make
least they're
sense.
Coherent. Right.
Coherent.
Yeah, they have.
They're a little long, but there's, like, visually, I thought they're really, I look great.
Yeah, they do. The they really do. Yeah. They ruined Dr. Loomis.
But the production design is, like, phenomenal.
There are certainly more positives in those two than in either of these. I would
but
say.
They're going to be gross.
They are very gross. They are quite offensive in some ways, but we're going to touch on them because we have to. And we're almost at the end here. The payoff for us is David Gordon Green's remake coming out this Thursday.
We do an Oscar sprint, but we do a Halloween marathon, folks. And we're barely hanging on.
Yes.
And we're smokers.
We knew.
And
we knew it was going to come off a cliff at some point, and we're definitely
heaving.
Free fall. Yeah.
It's the day after the marathon, but there's like one guy crawling towards the finish line still. That's us.
And you can let us know if we're wrong about these. Tell us if you love these movies. I won't blame you. I love 6, but it's not good. But let us know how you feel about them. Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, MM and Oscar on the Twitter machine, Mike and Oscar at gmail.com, and on Reddit. Michael, I'm afraid to even ask, but final words of wisdom here?
Listen to our next podcast. Listen to our last few podcasts.
Yeah.
The Halloween movies you ought to watch are 1, 2,
Scott the Laurie Strode ones.
The Laurie Strode, H2O, 4 has some watchability, 5 barely, yeah. But 5, 6, and Resurrection are ass. They're just ass. Terrible.
Good words of wisdom. Reality sucks, guys. Keep watching these horror movies with us, and we will see you soon.
See ya.